I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision yesterday that's related to our upcoming interview about deportations and the Philadelphia Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The court overturned the deportation of a man born in the Philippines, was a legal permanent resident, and had been convicted of two burglaries. The court ruled that the provision in the immigration law involving deportation for a violent crime was too vague, too fuzzy, as Justice Kagan wrote in the majority opinion. Interestingly, Neil Gorsuch, the new justice on the court, sided with the more liberal members of the court in this case. We asked Mark Joseph Stern to join us to help us understand what this decision means, and he covers the courts and the law for Slate. Mark Joseph Stern, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So what do we need to know about this man, James Garcia de Maya?
Well, de Maya was convicted, as you said, twice for burglary under California law, and he was detained and set for deportation, but he challenged the deportation that was about to occur, in fact, because he argued that the law that allowed him to be deported was unconstitutionally vague. Under the Due Process Clause of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, a law that has either criminal consequences or is a deportation statute has to provide an ordinary person with fair notice of what kind of conduct is prohibited, what kind of conduct is going to trigger these consequences. And de Maya argued that the law that allowed for his deportation, which was a very hazy kind of sweeping law, quite poorly drafted and difficult to parse, just didn't pass due process muster. That is an argument that was accepted on the Ninth Circuit, and now the Supreme Court has affirmed that decision in a 5-4 ruling that will spare de Maya from deportation.
Now, we should say that this case goes actually back to the Obama administration. It's been in the system for a number of years now.
That's exactly right. This is not a Trump administration position. This was a case that first arose under Obama, and it was Obama's Justice Department that first pushed back against de Maya and argued that this law was constitutional. That's no big surprise, because this is a federal law, and the Justice Department is tasked with defending the constitutionality of federal laws. Only very rarely, perhaps once in a generation, will the Justice Department conclude that a law is unconstitutional and decline to defend it. The Obama administration did that with DOMA, the gay marriage ban in the federal government, but it hasn't done that with any other laws. The Trump administration probably won't either. This is not a purely political case. It's really a case about the jurisprudence, constitutional principles, and it's not as if Gorsuch delivered a rebuke to the Trump administration here. That would be a misframing of the decision.
But it is a case involving burglary, which is against the law, correct?
Yes, that's true. True, but as the court pointed out, California's burglary statute is a very odd one. This statute does not even require unlawful entry for a person to have committed burglary. It is so broad, in fact, that it could cover a dishonest door-to-door salesman. A door-to-door salesman who lies a bit in his sales pitch could be convicted of burglary under this statute. And the court said, look, that is an example of why this law that triggers deportation is way too broad, because while it claims to only subject individuals who have committed violent crimes to deportation, its definition of violent crimes sweeps too broadly and encompasses too many crimes that do not actually involve violence. That is fundamentally unfair. It violates the fundamental fairness that lies at the heart of the Due Process Clause, and more pertinently for constitutional purposes, it deprives the ordinary person of fair notice as to what kind of conduct will get him deported.
If he had a gun, and I don't believe he did, but if a weapon was used in a burglary, would that make it a crime of violence?
Well, it probably would, but here's the important thing to note. This statute lists a number of other crimes that can subject an individual to deportation, and that would probably fall under that list. The clause that the Supreme Court struck down is called a residual clause, and it is meant to sweep in a bunch of other crimes that the federal government couldn't think of but wanted judges to include anyway. And that is always a problem. Just a few years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a very similar criminal statute, in an opinion written by Justice Antonin Scalia, who's certainly no, progressive or liberal, but he concluded that this really vague law that tried to, criminalize all of this conduct without explaining what it was, couldn't pass muster under due process because no ordinary person could figure out what was actually prohibited. Justice Scalia memorably wrote, should the person just Google it or go by gut instinct? Judges are not supposed to make up criminal law. That is a job for the legislature, and that's what the court concluded yesterday.
Well, let me quote some of what Justice Gorsuch said. He said, today's vague laws, and I'm editing here as I go along, can invite the exercise of arbitrary power by leaving people in the dark about what the law demands and allowing prosecutors and courts to make it up. Is he basically seconding what Scalia just said?
Yes, absolutely. And he's taking this a step farther to talk about the separation of powers principle here, which I think is important to note. You know, this is a due process case, but Gorsuch wrote in his separate concurrence that there are also key separation of power principles because Congress makes the law and it is up to the judiciary to interpret and enforce them. But when Congress makes a law that's so vague that judges have to basically rewrite it to figure out what it means, then judges are doing the job of the legislature. And that goes strongly against what the Constitution requires, which is that the legislature make the laws. And so for Gorsuch, this is not just a case about personal liberty and due process. This is a case about the proper role of the judiciary. He does not want judges rewriting these statutes. He wants lawmakers to do that job and just let him enforce the laws written.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mark Joseph Stern. He covers courts and the law for Slate. And we called him up this morning on Radio Times to have us explain a decision, a really important decision, actually. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court issuing a 5-4 decision. It involves the proposed deportation of a man who was actually born in the Philippines and was living here as a legal permanent resident and was slated for deportation because of two burglary convictions. And the court basically overturned that decision because they found that the language of the law at stake was just too vague, too fuzzy, as Justice Kagan said. You can join us. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, to join our conversation. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mark, let me go back to you. Now, he is a legal permanent resident. What does that mean?
So that means that he was admitted into the United States legally, and he has been living here legally, almost certainly with a green card. And green card holders, they're allowed to live here legally, but they are not subject to the same rights and protections as citizens. One big problem for green card holders is that if they commit a certain kind of law, they may be banished. They may be expelled from the country, which cannot happen to citizens. So this was a huge issue for the court and particularly for the dissenters. In the case yesterday, we saw Justice Clarence Thomas writing, he wasn't even sure if legal permanent residents have due process rights in the United States.
Oh,
Justice Thomas's jurisprudence, notoriously unfriendly to aliens living in the country. Justice Gorsuch strongly rejected that. In a kind of battle of the originalists, Justice Gorsuch traced back the history of due process to the founding of the country and determined that, in fact, men like DeMaio, people like DeMaio, who have green cards but aren't citizens, still receive the same due process rights generally as citizens of the United States.
And if he had been or if he were to be undocumented, would that have changed what the court decided?
Yes, well, it would have been an entirely different case because it's much easier to expel undocumented immigrants from the country, right? Undocumented immigrants have to make an affirmative showing that they have some reason that they should be able to stay. For instance, that they're seeking asylum, right? But for a lawful permanent resident, they have a presumptive ability to stay in this country, at least as long as their papers allow them to, and the government has to make a showing as to why it should be able to expel them. And that was key to the posture of this case. case. This was the federal government trying to prove that it had a statutory right to expel Mr. DiMaia without affording him really a sufficient level of process. That's what this case was about. It doesn't have clear implications for undocumented immigrants, but it should provide at least a little sigh of relief to all the green card holders living in America that at the very least the federal government cannot apply an arbitrary and capricious law to kick them out.
So DiMaia is free to live in the United States, hopefully will not be committing future burglaries.
Yes, that's right. We can hope so. And, you know, there will be further proceedings in this case, but it does seem that DiMaia will be able to stay, presuming he can follow the law and keep his head above water.
The president tweeted, this was last night, today's court decision means that Congress must close loopholes that block the removal of dangerous criminal aliens, including aggravated felons. This is a public safety issue that can only be fixed by Congress. Is he correct about that?
He is correct that it can only be fixed by Congress, but I think he overstates the damage that this decision does to the broader scheme here. This decision strikes down one provision of a very lengthy law. And as I said, it's a provision that's designed to sweep in a bunch of lesser offenses that Congress couldn't think of when it was writing the statute. All of those bigger, more grievous offenses that you can think of, you know, murder, violence, actual crimes involving violence, for the most part, are still encompassed by this law, still operational. And so it's not as if every legal permanent resident can now run out of a detention center because the Supreme Court struck down this provision. No, it's a much narrower ruling than that. If Congress wants to go back and tweak the law to restore something like this provision, it can try to, but the court has telegraphed now over and over again that it doesn't like these catch-all clauses. It doesn't like these vague, sweeping clauses that try to capture a bunch of conduct that lawmakers couldn't think of because, as I said earlier, that is a separation of powers problem, it's a due process problem, and it just doesn't give people fair notice.
But is it possible to even write a law that would be so specific to know what would be a crime that would result in deportation for someone like DiMaia?
I think that it is, and I think that if Congress wanted to write a law that subjected even a dishonest door-to-door salesman, for instance, to deportation, Congress could do that. But that's not what Congress wanted to do here, and that was part of the problem. You know, this residual clause that got struck down wound up sweeping in probably more conduct than Congress had even intended. Because courts were unsure how to interpret it, some went dramatically draconian, and some were very lenient. And it's quite possible for Congress to go back and just list elements of the crimes that will subject an individual to deportation, list specifically what kind of crimes will subject individuals to deportation, give examples of the crimes that it is worried about, but that's not what Congress did here. I think that a couple of smart lawyers can work with congressmen to fix this very small hole that the court has carved through the law, but in truth, I don't think this is going to be a big deal. It's not going to affect that many individuals, and for the most part, it's not going to affect individuals who are genuinely dangerous because, again, they are already liable under a different part of the law.
Well, Mark, I have some more questions for you, so hopefully you can stay with us after this very short break. Mark Joseph Stern covers courts and the law for Slate, talking about a really interesting decision yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with deportation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Again, I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Mark Joseph Stern, who covers the courts and the law for Slate, talking about a decision yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. Mark, Justice Kagan wrote the majority opinion. What did she say?
Well, Justice Kagan said largely what Justice Scalia said in the predecessor case here, which was that if you look at the record of courts trying to interpret this provision of the law, they are coming to dramatically different conclusions about what conduct actually falls under the scope of this law and what conduct does not. That is an excellent guider to suggest that this law itself has a fundamental problem. And Justice Kagan said, we cannot figure out what it actually means, what conduct it's meant to include. And so under the Due Process Clause, we have to invalidate it and prevent lower courts from applying it at all.
There were, of course, dissenters, including Chief Justice Roberts. What did they say?
Well, Chief Justice Roberts was an interesting vote here because he did join the predecessor decision written by Justice Scalia, which held that a very similar criminal law was unconstitutionally vague. But here, he seemed to see a distinction between that criminal law and this deportation statute. Deportation is a civil matter rather than a criminal one, even though it obviously has very grave consequences for the individual who's deported. And he also thought that this law was more specific than the previous one. He thought that this was less confusing, less arbitrary, and so judges should be able to use it as a guidepost to figure out what conduct it encompasses. He and Justice Kagan got into a bit of a battle of the footnotes over that, and I have to say I do think that Justice Kagan got the better of the argument.
Well, Mark Joseph Stern, thank you so much. We called you up right before the show began. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. Again, he covers courts and the law for Slate. Well, candidate Donald Trump made deportation of undocumented immigrants a centerpiece of his campaign. Here he is at a 2016 debate.
One of my first acts will be to get all of the drug lords, all of the bad ones. We have some bad, bad people in this country that have to go out. We're going to get them out. We're going to secure the border. And once the border is secured, at a later date, we'll make a determination as to the rest. But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
President Trump, along with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, have stepped up deportations and gone after sanctuary cities like Philadelphia. A series by ProPublica and the Philadelphia Inquirer found that the Philadelphia Office of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has been more aggressive than other ICE offices in arresting undocumented immigrants who don't have criminal convictions. Their jurisdiction includes Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia. The reporters documented the use of sweeps and collateral arrests of people who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and ended up deported or in the immigration court system. The series is titled No Sanctuary, The Unshackling of ICE. Joining us is the co-author of the series, Dale Rusikoff. She's at the NPR studios in New York City. Dale, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
We asked a representative of ICE to join us. They declined, but they did send us a statement, which I will read during the hour. Dale, what led to this investigation?
Well, Debbie Sontag, my co-author, and I wanted, shortly after Trump took office, just to take a look, a really in-depth look at what difference this was going to make for ICE and for undocumented immigrants and for communities around the country. And so this was very early in the Trump administration. We started just reading the press releases that every regional office of ICE, there are 24 of them, many of them have multiple states, like the Philadelphia region, which has Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Delaware. And they were putting out press releases about operations they were conducting once Trump took office. And these were region-wide concentrated efforts of all of the ICE officers in a region to go out and arrest people who they had warrants for, they had concerns about, they had, you know, in their files, people who had been, you know, looked at in the past by ICE and maybe passed over, but this time they were going to bring them in. So anyway, we looked at these, and in the very first round of them, the Philadelphia Office of ICE had more than twice the percentage of people without criminal convictions being arrested. They broke this down in the first press releases. As all the other regions, like you could look at the national number, which was like under 30% of people being arrested by ICE in these operations had a criminal conviction. But the Philadelphia region, it would be like over 60%, 66% in one of the press releases. And we just thought, this is really kind of striking and interesting, and we wanted to just look at it and see, well, what does that look like? What does that feel like? Why is that happening? How does that affect the way the ICE office conducts itself, the way undocumented immigrant communities conduct themselves, the way industries that depend, you know, on undocumented immigrants are reacting? We just wanted to take the most comprehensive look we could. And as the year went on, this continued where Philadelphia ended up almost 65% of the people that they've arrested since Trump became president are people with no criminal convictions. And the rest of the country has actually bumped up a little. It's getting closer to 40%. So in a way, while it looked like Philadelphia was an outlier, it now looks like Philadelphia might be a harbinger of where this is going. That, you know, ICE was more restrained in some other regions, but that's changing as time goes on.
How do you define undocumented immigrants without criminal convictions?
Well, these are people who have either had never had any contact with law enforcement, never been arrested for anything. They are people who maybe have been charged with a crime but haven't had a trial yet. There's no resolution. Yeah, those two categories.
As I mentioned, we asked ICE to send a representative to join us. They declined that, but they did send a statement. And I'm going to read parts of it during our interview here. One of the things that the statement says is ICE deportation officers do not conduct sweeps or raids that target aliens indiscriminately. ICE's enforcement actions are targeted and lead-driven. ICE conducts targeted immigration enforcement in compliance with federal law and agency policy. What your series is about is the use of these sweeps where ICE might be targeting a specific individual that they see as a threat, and they find other individuals who do not have these criminal convictions, but they get swept up in some kind of arrest. ICE is saying, we don't do that.
Well, it's certainly their policy not to do that, but we found quite a number of cases where that is what happened. I mean, we had one case of a van that was picking up mushroom workers one by one all over central Pennsylvania to go to the Avondale area to pick mushrooms, and an ICE car was following them, and when the van was full, it stopped them. They didn't have a warrant for anyone. They weren't asking about anyone in particular, but they took everyone whom they could fit in their van into custody and put them into deportation proceedings. We had another case of a poultry transport company. This is another kind of interesting piece of the agriculture business in central Pennsylvania. But these are this is a big company that transports poultry from farms to one farm to another, or, you know, they have all these different relationships. And they have people who work for them who are informally called chicken catchers. It's their job to go out and just, you know, round up the chickens, put them in the pens, and get them on the truck and get them out of there. And it's the most horrific, grueling job. And everyone who does it is undocumented. And so at this particular place, ICE officers showed up. There were no trespassing signs. They crossed them. They didn't have a warrant. They said they were looking for someone who worked for a different poultry transport company. They told ICE, that's a different company. That's not this company, and that person doesn't work here. We've never heard of that person. And they nonetheless lined up all of the Hispanic workers against the wall, ignoring all the non-Hispanic workers, except to ask them, are there any other Hispanic workers here? And then they put all of them into custody. So there have been, you know, that is definitely their policy, but from what we've reported, it doesn't seem to be their practice in all cases.
Looking at these farmers who hire these undocumented immigrants, and you're talking about Pennsylvania here, whether it's a poultry farm or mushroom farms, what's been their response to what ICE has been doing?
Well, they're very upset about it. I talked to quite a number of people who are, you know, they call these workers essential workers. In fact, there's a leading person in agriculture in Pennsylvania named Luke Brubaker, who's in the dairy business, who met with President Trump last year, like maybe it's been almost a year ago now, to talk about. And he was with leaders of farming in states all around the country who met with Trump to say, you know, these are essential workers. You have to come up with a different approach. There has to be a waiver, or there has to be a process or something, because we don't have any other way to get our workers.
What was their response?
Well, Trump said that this is not intended to target you and we'll look into it. But it has, you know, I don't think anybody in Pennsylvania feels that it has changed. And I actually, Mr. Brubaker, he had not ever been targeted in the dairy industry, but he knew people in other, and he knew that this poultry transport company, which is in his area, and he actually raised that specific case to President Trump. But then we also talked to I talked to people in the apple orchard field, and they are incredibly upset. Many of them voted for Trump. But they did not expect this to happen. And they also said they didn't feel that they could speak out because they felt that ICE might retaliate and target them and come do another action at their orchard.
Well, going back to this chicken farm, so who was doing – this is the title of the job, chicken catching. Who was doing the chicken catching now?
Initially, after all of those people were taken into custody, because they had a contract and they had to catch some chickens and deliver them, they went to a temp firm and hired 13 people who were all legal residents, and not one of them lasted even an hour at the job because it's filthy, you're dealing with feces, there's like feathers in the air, it's physically incredibly hard to run around and catch these chickens. So they actually had to turn the contract over to another company. But now these people have gotten out on bond and they are back at work, at least, you know, as their case is moving along.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dale Rusikoff, and she's co-author of this series. It's a combined series between ProPublica and the Philadelphia Inquirer called No Sanctuary, The Unshackling of ICE. And it's about the fact that the Philadelphia Office of ICE, and I should add that that includes Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia, has been more aggressive than other ICE offices arresting undocumented immigrants who do not have criminal convictions. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me go back to this ICE statement that was sent over to us. It ends by saying, all of those in violation of the immigration laws may be subject to immigration arrest, detention, and if found removable by final order, removed from the United States. What ICE is saying, and there's some truth to this, if you are an undocumented immigrant in this country, you have broken a law because you are here illegally. Is that what sort of guides ICE, which is essentially whether someone has done something violent or something that really is much more criminal, the fact that they're here illegally makes them criminals?
Well, it actually doesn't make them criminals because illegal presence in the country is a civil violation. It's not a criminal violation. But they are saying that they have broken a law, they are here illegally, and they are removable. And that is true. But under past administrations, not just the Obama administration, the Bush administration was the same, ICE had priorities. And if someone had committed a violent crime, that person was a priority for deportation. If someone hadn't, they would, if they encountered someone who was, a law-abiding person who'd been here a long time, who had a family here, who had ties to their community, they would often just let them go. And we actually came across quite a number of people who are in deportation proceedings now who, one of them was somebody who, during the Bush administration, had been put in prison by a local police department because he was driving without a license, and it was his third time being caught. So that that the penalty for that in that town is a weekend in jail. And ICE had come and interviewed this man and had decided to just let him go because he had been working in this country for a long time and he was not a threat. He'd never committed a crime other than driving without a license. And then this person was one of the people rounded up in one of ICE's big operations in the Philadelphia region. And they didn't have any trouble. They had his name in their files because ICE had contact with him, more than 10 years ago when this happened. And when they went to look for him, he was at the same address. He had never bothered to move. He wasn't a flight risk of any kind. But then, they sent six different officers to pick him up as if he were a violent criminal. And so this is another question of just the use of ICE resources to deport people who have never posed a threat to the country versus using those resources to focus on those who pose the greatest threat.
It's interesting. We're talking to you from a sanctuary city. Philadelphia is a sanctuary city. ICE, it's the Philadelphia Office of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. How does the fact that Philadelphia is a sanctuary city, how does that affect what ICE does?
Well, it affects ICE because when someone is, say, in prison and is about to get out of prison or has served their time, Philadelphia will not hold them extra days for ICE to come and pick them up. They say that, you know, they call themselves not a sanctuary city but a Fourth Amendment city, that mm-hmm. the Fourth Amendment guarantee of protection from search and seizure means that nobody can hold you when, you know, there's not a judicial reason to hold you. ICE feels that Philadelphia is particularly uncooperative, and what they say is that because sanctuary cities like Philadelphia won't help them take people into custody from jails and prisons, they have to go out looking for these people in the community, and they say that they're going to inevitably come into contact with other people who are here illegally because they might live in the same apartment complex, they might work at the same place, and that's the reason that they're taking so many, you know, people into custody mm-hmm. who don't have criminal records. That's ICE's answer for that.
We're about a minute away from our break here. Is there a quota? Does ICE have a quota?
Not that we could find, but there is pressure on ICE to keep what they call numbers up, to have – they're evaluated nationally by, you know, the number of people they're taking into custody and putting into deportation proceedings.
And do you know why Philadelphia's numbers are higher than others?
You know, we would love to know that. That nobody in the Philadelphia office was allowed to talk to us, and nobody in the ICE National office would speak to us about this on the record. And so we don't know the reason, but many people suspect that the reason is that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has a tremendous beef against Philadelphia for this practice, and that there may have been pressure because of that coming out of Washington on this region of ICE in particular.
Interesting. I mean, Philadelphia is not the only Fourth Amendment city, but interesting.
No, it's not. And, you know, that if you look at San Francisco, Chicago, the numbers are not like this there. And those are cities with much larger undocumented populations.
Well, Dale, there are a lot of people that want to join our conversation. Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Dale Rusakoff. She's a longtime former longtime reporter for the Washington Post, co-author of this series, a combination between ProPublica and the Philadelphia Inquirer called No Sanctuary, The Unshackling of ICE. And again, we asked ICE to join us. They did send us a statement. I've been reading bits and pieces of it as we've been talking with our guest, Dale Rusakoff. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap here, we're talking about our recent three-part series from ProPublica and the Philadelphia Inquirer that found that Philadelphia's Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, is the most aggressive in the country in terms of the volume of arrests of those with no criminal records. They reporters attribute this to so-called at-large arrests taking place, detaining undocumented people who are not the target of an investigation but are found incidentally. Dale Rusakoff is our guest. She is co-author of this report and, again, a former longtime reporter for The Washington Post. Let me get Tina from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And, Tina, go ahead. You're on the air. Tina, go ahead. You are on the air. No, we do not have Tina. All right. We will. Then let me ask a couple of questions while we get that straightened away. I do want to talk, Dale, about some of the people that you write about, including a cook from Guatemala. That's really how the series begins. A man named Ludwin Franco. He marries a waitress, a woman, from the Pennsylvania Dutch country in 2013. What happened to him?
Well, he was going to a soccer match one night, and he had actually gotten so concerned about the crackdown in ICE enforcement that he had stopped driving because in Pennsylvania, undocumented immigrants can't have licenses, mm-hmm. and he was afraid of being stopped. But his wife was pregnant with their third child, and she was really not feeling well, and his team really needed him. So he headed out. And a car pulled out of a restaurant and on the highway when he was driving, and he swerved to miss it, but he hit it. And both cars were totaled, but nobody was injured. And, you know, everyone was let go. But ICE sometimes, you know, he was charged with driving without a license, and ICE monitors these local charges. And so, you know, days later, ICE picked him up and put him into deportation proceedings. And he was sent back to Guatemala, and when his wife had the baby that she had been pregnant with, he was, you know, home in his mother's, you know, really small rural house and watching on his cell phone screen the birth of his daughter. And he was so miserable, and his wife and children were so miserable that he took it upon himself to try to cross the border again. And that happened just recently, and he was caught and sent back to Guatemala. So the family is just completely broken now.
You also add that I guess his wife received a letter 16 months after application granting an interview so that she could have her husband legalized. Did I read that correctly?
Yes. No, they had been he had been in the country 10 years, and they had been advised by lawyers that it's best to wait until you've been in the country 10 years. You've got a perfectly clean record. He'd been working, paying taxes. They had children. And that would be a good time to start legalization. But then, you know, they weren't expecting that Trump would be elected and that this whole environment would change. So they were in the process to legalize him as the husband of an American citizen. And that's when he was deported. And apparently the, you know, Citizenship Division of Department of Homeland Security doesn't talk to the ICE division, and so that process was continuing to go on. And while, you know, while he was being deported a second time, she was told that, you know, she could now come in for the interview to legalize him.
And so she's in Pennsylvania, he's still in Guatemala, and their future together is uncertain.
Well, extremely.
Extremely, right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, she's even thinking, like, is there a third country they could move to?
Let me get some callers in. I'm going to try Phil from Long Valley, New Jersey. And Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. Your guest before was mentioning ethnic profiling. I used to live in southwest Kansas on the border of Oklahoma and Colorado. And we had undocumented immigrants from Mexico who just happened to have blonde hair and blue eyes. They were a group of Mennonites that had migrated to Mexico about over 100 years ago and had never married outside of their local community. And immigration sweeps were relatively routine in some of the factory hog farms and the hog processing centers. And they never once looked at these people with blonde hair and blue eyes because they never once suspected they were undocumented migrants from Mexico.
That's fascinating, Phil. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dale, are we talking racial profiling here?
Well, this is, again, something that ICE says they don't do, and that the Pennsylvania State Police, who are another part of the story that we haven't discussed yet, said they don't do. But our reporting shows that, you know, at least some officers do it because, for example, the raid on the chicken catchers, you know, they went into this plant. And they didn't have a warrant for anybody. They wanted only to look at the IDs and papers of the people who looked Hispanic. And there were all these other workers there who happened to be, you know, American citizens. And they didn't ask to look at any of their documents.
Phil, again, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me read some comments. One, you named Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia, but not New Jersey. Is that right? Lots of agriculture in South New Jersey. But, Dale, the Philadelphia ICE office does not cover New Jersey, just so there's clarity.
That's
on
correct.
That.
That's correct, yeah. New Jersey's in a different region.
An email from Rich, aren't the companies using illegal labor to blame here? We should not allow companies to use undocumented laborers as a way to sustain these unethical businesses with horrible working conditions, artificially low wages, and an environment where workers can't unionize. And there is a point there, it seems. But it's interesting, Dale, you were saying this farm trying to replace the so-called chicken catchers were unable to find local people who could do that work.
Right, either who could or who would do it. But I, you know, I don't think that the person who wrote that is that off base. I mean, there is a lot of abuse of undocumented workers, and a couple of the orchard people who, you know, orchard managers who I spoke to said they had actually tried to get workers. There's a guest worker program where you can bring people in for limited periods of time from Mexico, Guatemala, Central America, really anywhere if they're willing to come and work. But they said that that system is so backlogged that they couldn't get people in time for the harvest, so that they had ended up hiring the people they could get.
You talked about state troopers. And again, we're focusing largely on Pennsylvania, but that obviously makes sense because that's where we are. And specifically about a state trooper named Luke Mack. Who is he?
Well, Luke Mackey is a state trooper based in Carlisle. And he has been a trooper for 9 years. He's 35 years old. He grew up in Carlisle. And we were not able to interview him, but we found case after case where he was stopping people on interstate highways in central Pennsylvania who were Hispanic. In almost every case, he did give a ticket, and it was like for speeding or for having tinted windows or not having a seatbelt or looking at their phones. But then he would immediately ask them for their papers. In some cases, before he asked them for their any ID of any kind, he wanted to know if they were legal or illegal. And then if they couldn't prove that they were here legally, he would hold them – he would call ICE and hold them without a warrant in one case for 4 hours until ICE came. In reporting, we found 19 people that he had put into deportation proceedings this way. The state police have no authority to enforce immigration law. Mm-hmm. The Fourth Amendment prevents you from holding someone without a warrant. There's a number of Supreme Court opinions that say that a traffic stop cannot lead to, you can't use a traffic stop to investigate someone for other issues or crimes unless you have probable cause. And the only probable cause that he had was that these people looked Hispanic. And as I said, it's not a crime to be here illegally. It's a civil violation. So there were all kinds of issues with that. And we asked the state police to comment on it. And, I asked specifically, under what authority do the police hold people without a warrant when they stop them for traffic infractions? Because we found other state police doing this. And they refused to answer my question. But what's very interesting that I found, I was just curious, like the state of Pennsylvania and the state police have no guidelines or policy saying what rights an undocumented person has when they're stopped by the state police. They don't train their police officers in what they can and can't do legally, constitutionally when they stop someone who's undocumented. But like Trooper Mackey, he patrols I-81. That's where most of his tickets come. And I-81 enters Pennsylvania from Maryland, and it exits Pennsylvania into New York. And both of those states have explicit rules and policies saying that you may not ask people for their immigration papers. That is unconstitutional. You may not hold someone without a warrant for a pickup by ICE. That is unconstitutional. It's just like very explicit. So if you are stopped in Maryland on I-81 for not having a seatbelt, you'll be ticketed and sent on your way. But if you are stopped on I-81 by this particular trooper for the same infraction on the same interstate, you could end up being deported.
I saw that this was brought to the attention of Governor Wolf. Has there been any response either from the head of the state troopers or the governor to this, I guess, aberration between these two states?
Well, we gave the governor the first 8 examples that we came upon of not just this trooper, but all troopers who were doing this. And we asked for his comment, and he asked the state police to investigate. He said, we do not allow bias-based policing in the state of Pennsylvania. He asked them to investigate. And then as of March, we hadn't heard anything about a state police investigation or review being done. So there didn't seem to be a lot of urgency. But when we got back to them and said we now had, over 2 dozen cases and 19 of them with this one trooper, the governor said that they are reevaluating their policies and they will look at the policies of other states in considering this, and that, and as it turns out, the head of the state police, who'd been there quite a while, retired in March, and they have a new leadership, and they said the new leadership is committed to, observing rights. But I just want to say that we, in the last 2 weeks, have heard of a number of cases of state troopers doing the exact same thing with people they stopped. And in particular, the other thing I just wanted to mention was this Officer Mackey. We found a number of Hispanic people who were born in this country who were American citizens who he stopped and immediately asked them for their papers. And, you know, they were so upset. And when we called them and told them we were doing this article, they said that they had been so upset about this, but they didn't know whom to call.
If so many people are getting arrested, then they're being put into the immigration system and have to go before a judge. You also document these huge caseloads of judges trying to figure out, you know, what to do about all these cases.
Right. And we actually interviewed a longtime immigration court judge in Pennsylvania named Walter Durling. He had been on the bench 24 years, and he retired at the end of last year. And judges aren't allowed to speak to the press, but once he was retired, he said he would agree to. And he said publicly in our series that he really disagreed with the policy ICE has of now just, you know, putting everyone they come into contact with who's undocumented into deportation proceedings. He thinks it's overloading the system and wasting resources. And, you know, he said people are coming before him who, you know, were arrested for loitering or, you know, public urinating or something. And he said, why are we bothering with, as he called it, these piddling cases?
We're almost out of time here, but I do want to talk about Fred and Linda Ammerman. And I have to say, a lot of the comments here are saying just how depressing this whole discussion is. But tell us about Fred and Linda Ammerman.
They are retirees who live in Bucks County, and they had a gardener who had been working for them for years, they'd become incredibly close to. They told the story of how once in a huge snowstorm, he had come over there after working a full day somewhere else and shoveled out their driveway with a very small shovel, the only thing available. And she said, you know, our own children wouldn't have done this for us. He also worked on a horse farm and was, according to the person who ran the horse farm, just the most skilled handler of horses they'd ever seen. He'd been coming back and forth to this country for decades, you know, going back to his family in Central America, coming back to work here and make money and send it back to the family. And then he was picked up. And because he had been stopped crossing the border in the past, the ICE ended up referring him for a criminal case because there is, while being here illegally is not a crime, there's something called illegal reentry after deportation that is a felony. So the Justice Department charged him with that, and he was tried as a felon, and they ordered him deported. And Mr. and Mrs. Ammerman actually came to the courthouse for his hearing before the immigration judge, and they spoke about him, they broke down in tears, and the judge was Puerto Rican, and she started, you know, talking about her own feelings about, you know, that this man wasn't a danger to the country and wasn't a bad person. And, you know, the attorney who was representing him also was Hispanic, and she said the same thing. So it was kind of like this courtroom that showed you that, you know, there is a lot of connection between legal residents and citizens who are Hispanic and those who are here without legal status.
Obviously, we're almost out of time here. And where is he today?
He's back in Central America. He was deported.
Deb Witzkoff, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And we've been talking about a series between the Philadelphia Inquirer and ProPublica called No Sanctuary, The Unshackling of ICE. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and John Aronson, starting today with assistance from Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.